Okay, I'm going to talk a bit about realism and anti-realism. This is a large topic, and I won't do more than scratch the surface of it. Well, the debate between realism and its opponents is a very old one in philosophy. The debates over some kind of realism or another go back at least to Plato. And the debate that Plato started over realism about ideas or universals, that has gone on ever since and was particularly prominent in the Middle Ages, when the main opponent of that form of realism came to be called nominalism, and that label has stuck. And the debate between realism and nominalism about universals is still going strong. You also have a debate between realism and phenomenalism about our experience of the external world, debates in mathematics between realists or Platonists and intuitionists or constructivists. You have realism against instrumentalism in the philosophy of science, realism against relativism and subjectivism in ethics, and so on. There are quite a few areas where you can find some version of realism as a position that some philosophers take up, and an opposing position which may have its own special name depending on the area in question. And the various areas are so diffuse that there's no particular expectation that if you're a realist in one area, you will be a realist in another area. You might be a moral realist, a moral objectivist, but in the philosophy of science, you might be an instrumentalist. So a question arises as to whether all these various disputes between some form or other of realism and its opponents can or should be unified in any way. Should they be treated as part of one debate? Or are they quite separate debates, and the use of the word realist in all of them is to be thought of as a bit of an equivocation? Well, Michael Dummett tried to unify and advance the debate by attempting to reduce or recast the disagreement between these various realisms and their oppositions to a disagreement over the meaning of a sentence or a statement. Whether that meaning should be given in terms of truth conditions, which he took to be the realist position, or conditions warranting its justified assertion or assertability conditions. And he labelled that position anti-realism, a new label, so as not to cause confusion with various forms of older opposition to realism. So realism is a position that the meaning of a statement is given by its truth conditions, and anti-realism is a position that the meaning of a statement is given by its assertability conditions, the conditions under which it would be warranted to assert it. Well, since Dummett is trying to unify lots of different debates, bring them all under one head, you would expect his characterization of the essential difference between realism and anti-realism not necessarily to align with traditional ways of thinking about the dispute between the realist and the realist's opponents. And I think that's indeed what we find. I mean, traditionally, if you ask the question, well, what, before Dummett came along, what would the characteristic mark of a realist have been in any area? Then I think the answer would have been something along the lines of, it's a position which has to do with independence, the independence of things of some sort from our ways of conceiving them. Basically, the independence of the world from human or similar ways of thinking or talking about the world. And I think a realist as traditionally conceived would have wanted to insist on that kind of independence, whereas the opponent of realism, whether an idealist in the Berkeleyan mould, for example, or some other sort of realist, would have wanted to say, well, no, in some sense, reality is not independent of our ways of conceiving it. So, I mean, Berkeley's idealistic position would even say that the world is constructed out of, entities that are internal to our mind, appearances, percepts, sense data, things like that. And that the whole idea of a genuinely independent material reality, that's just incoherent, Berkeley argues. So Dummett's characterization of the debate between realism and anti-realism is quite surprising, because at first blush it wouldn't seem as though that was an accurate way of capturing, say, the dispute between Berkeley and idealism and a realism about the world. It doesn't seem obviously to be a debate about truth conditions versus assertability conditions. But Dummett's claim is not so much that his way of casting the debate between realism and anti-realism is faithful to traditional ways of considering the matter. It's more that in the nature of a recommendation to transpose the debate between realism and its various oppositions into these new meaning theoretic terms. And the reason why he thinks that that would be a good idea is that he thinks we would thereby give more precision to these traditional debates and maybe have some prospect of arriving at some answers. I mean, what he obviously feels is that the way that the traditional debates have often been conducted was in terms of just swapping metaphors and pictures, and that people were largely talking past each other. They weren't conducting the debate in a sufficiently rigorous way. And so the suggestion is that we have some prospect of doing that. If we recast these traditional, broadly speaking, metaphysical disputes into a dispute in the philosophy of language. Okay, so if we re-express the dispute between realism and the opposition to realism of whatever form it took traditionally, if we re-express that in terms of a dispute about the kind of meaning that statements have, then we have a chance of A, giving precision to the whole debate, and B, maybe then arriving at some answer. And so the dispute between realism and anti-realism for Dummett becomes a dispute over the kind of meaning possessed by statements in any area of discourse, such as statements about the physical world, about mathematics, about morality, about the past and the future. Is the meaning of relevant statements constituted by their truth conditions or by their assertability conditions? And then I think, although I said that Dummett's characterization of the debate between realism and its oppositions cuts across traditional characterizations, I think he would respond that the point of connection is this, that, you know, we said that realism as traditionally conceived is really about independence, the independence of the world or some domain within the world, independence of human constructions. The realist taking a very strong objectivist line about that, the world or some whatever particular domain we're talking about is quite independent of what human beings say and think about it, whereas the anti-realist disputes that. That's the, as I say, that's more or less a traditional way of conceiving the debate. And the way it can be thought of as connecting up with Dummett's characterization, so that they don't look so far apart, is this, that if you take the realist line as Dummett conceives realism, that's to say, if you conceive of the meaning of a statement as given by its truth conditions, then an important implication of that for Dummett is that these truth conditions might be, as philosophers put it, verification transcendent. That's to say, they might exceed our powers of verification. We might not be able to ascertain whether a statement is true or false. That's not, as it were, part of the deal. That's not part of the package that the realist is offering. The realist is simply saying, look, if you've got a meaningful statement, what does its meaning consist in? Well, it consists in its truth conditions, the conditions under which it's true or false, and that's it. There's no implication in that statement that these truth conditions are necessarily ascertainable by us. They might exceed our powers of discovery. So the realist is allowing the statements to be meaningful and have truth conditions that may concern areas of the world in general, the remote past, say, or fundamental matter, or higher set theory, areas where we're simply not able to find out the truth of the matter. Nevertheless, for the realist, the statement's meaning is given in terms of its truth conditions, so truth conditions that possibly transcend our powers of ascertaining them. Dummett is thinking of the realist in that way. The anti-realist, by contrast, wants to stress the connection between the meaning of a statement and our methods of verifying it. So Dummett's anti-realist is a descendant of an old-style verificationist, logical positivist. So his anti-realist thinks that the meaning of a statement can't, as it were, cut loose from methods of verification in the way that the realist is happy to think of them. And that's why the anti-realist, Dummett's anti-realist, identifies meaning with assertability conditions, the conditions under which you would be justified in asserting a statement. I'll leave that point about verification hanging for a bit in order to refine what I've just said in general terms about the distinction between realism and anti-realism. In the light of some of the things we've already said, actually, in connection with Kripke's skeptical puzzle and skeptical solution. If you remember when we were talking about Kripke's interpretation of Wittgenstein, which we can now call an anti-realist interpretation in Dummett's sense, one point that I made, following other philosophers, is that although Kripke, in his skeptical solution, wanted to replace truth conditions with assertability conditions. So in other words, he wanted to say that the meaning of a statement is not given by its truth conditions, but rather by its assertability conditions. That was the move that Kripke wanted to make in his skeptical solution. If you remember at the time when we discussed that, I said, well, you can't make quite that move. It's simply incoherent to try and dissociate the meaning of a statement from its truth conditions. The connection between statements and their truth conditions is too close to allow us the option of construing statements' meanings in terms of assertability conditions instead of truth conditions. Rather, the anti-realist position, if it's to be coherent, should be the claim that a statement's meaning, that is to say its truth conditions, so truth conditions just being identified by everyone with the statement's meaning. The realist stops there, as it were, but the anti-realist goes on and says, well, no, there's more to say about these truth conditions, namely that they are constituted by assertability conditions. So assertability conditions, I was suggesting, should emerge in a properly thought-out anti-realism, not as a competitor to truth conditions, but rather as a gloss on what they must amount to. And I'm following here a point that Crispin Wright has made in several places. The connection between meaning and truth conditions is just too thin, if you like, too trivial to be denied. Everyone's got to accept that. But it doesn't take you very far. It doesn't solve the problem, doesn't settle the debate in the realist's favour. Rather, we should think of the debate as everyone starts off agreeing that meaning is to be identified with truth conditions. And then the question is, well, what is the nature of those truth conditions? And the anti-realist then comes along and tells a story, which the realist will dispute, that these truth conditions are tantamount to assertability conditions. That's the bit that the realist will deny. So that's a kind of a refinement, I think, on how the debate should be cast. And Dummett, like Kripke, doesn't put it in precisely those terms. So if that's accepted, it's a correction of the way Dummett himself sets up the debate. But I think it's one that leads to clarity of thought in this area. So the position would then be this. First of all, we identify the meaning of a statement with its truth conditions, and that part of the proceedings is not optional. But we then face a choice between anti-realism, which holds that truth conditions coincide with assertability conditions, and realism, which holds that they do not. And interestingly, you can see in that way of putting it, the anti-realist, as it were, is making the first move, is advancing a positive thesis, whereas realism is advancing the negative thesis. The realist is denying that claim that the anti-realist makes. And I think it's worth noting that point because what you find in some of the literature, for example, in some of the writings of John McDowell, is that it's quite an important point that it's the anti-realist who's the proponent in this debate rather than the realist. It's the anti-realist who's laying down a thesis, a new thesis, a radical thesis, and so has to justify that. The onus is on the anti-realist to make out a case, and all the realist needs to do in response is show that the anti-realist hasn't succeeded in doing that. So the realist position is entirely negative. It just consists in refuting the case made by the anti-realist. And then the realist is not, as it were, simply in virtue of this debate, is not under any obligation to go further and advance any kind of positive case. Okay, so just to pick up the earlier point, if you ask, well, what does it mean for truth conditions to coincide with assertability conditions, the answer, as I was, I guess, hinting above, would be that if we accept that coincidence, then what that means is that we reject the possibility of verification transcendent truth conditions. We reject the possibility that a statement might be given meaning in virtue of conditions that lie beyond our powers of verification. The truth conditions of a statement can't exceed our powers of recognizing circumstances that would warrant the assertion or denial of the statement in question. So that's the anti-realist strategy. The realist, by contrast, as I was saying, has the negative position, really, that truth conditions do not coincide with assertability conditions. And what that means, similarly, is that the realist countenances the possibility of verification transcendent truth conditions. So a meaningful statement can be true or false in such a way that we simply may not be able to get ourselves into a position where we can confirm the obtaining of the relevant state of affairs. So in other words, we can't get ourselves into a position of either corroborating or refuting the statement in question on the basis of evidence. Now, Dummett actually goes further in his characterization of the debate between realism and anti-realism than merely lining up realism with an acknowledgement of the possibility of verification transcendent truth conditions and anti-realism with a repudiation of that possibility. And his further suggestion is that realists also insist on what is known as the principle of bivalence. The principle that every proposition of the kind under dispute is determinately either true or false. That's a quote from Dummett from page 9 of The Logical Basis of Metaphysics. So proposition being here the meaning of a declarative sentence, the meaning of the sort of sentence that can be true or false. And the realist, according to this line, will say, well, the proposition expressed by a declarative sentence is either true or false. And that's an expression of the independence of reality or of the particular stretch of reality in question. So the idea is that for the realist, a proposition is true or false quite independently of our powers of verification, our methods of finding out whether it's true or false. A proposition, as it were, exists independently in splendid isolation from us, and a truth value accrues to it quite irrespective of any methods or means we might or might not have of finding out that truth value. And again, this way of characterizing the dispute between realism and anti-realism looks orthogonal to traditional ways of thinking about the dispute. That's to say, it seems to cut across those traditional ways. I mean, if the traditional sense of realism is that there's a domain of objectivity which is not constituted by human constructive activity, our mental activity, or our language, that doesn't seem obviously, if you're a realist in that sense, it doesn't seem obviously to commit you to embracing the principle of bivalence, of saying that every proposition, as we're now putting it, is either true or false. So, for example, you could be a realist in the sense of thinking that there's a domain of objectivity which is not constituted by human mental activity or linguistic activity. It's not a human construct. So it's genuinely objective. You're a realist in that traditional sense about this domain. But you might still have special reasons for wanting to restrict the principle of bivalence concerning statements about it. You might think that this domain, although fully independent of human beings, is not fully determinate in itself, so that certain statements about it don't have a determinate truth value. I mean, that's one line that some people have wanted to take about vagueness, for example. Vague statements being statements like, this is a heap, said of a pile of grains of sand, which is intermediate between clearly being a case of a heap and clearly not being a case of a heap, in the borderline intermediate case where we're not sure what to say about that kind of thing. One view might be that the statement, this is a heap, doesn't have a truth value. But that could be combined with a robust realism which says, well, reality is not in any way a human construct. There's vagueness in reality itself. Vagueness is not a product of human linguistic activity. So that would be a case of somebody who was a realist in the traditional sense, but nevertheless wanted to suspend bivalence. Or you could be an anti-realist in the traditional sense. That's to say, you could think that for some domain of discourse, the truth of statements about that domain is constituted by our mental activity, but you might nevertheless want to adhere to bivalence and say that statements about that domain are determinately either true or false. I mean, you know, your idea might be that this domain is one that we've constructed. It's not independently there. We've constructed it. We've set up the rules. And one of our rules is that all statements about that domain are determinately either true or false. We've set this domain up and we've made it fully determinate. Now, Dummett's realist and anti-realist can both be thought of as taking their cue from an aspect of Frege's philosophy. So his realist starts from Frege's suggestion that the meaning of a declarative sentence is given by its truth conditions. Frege makes that suggestion explicitly, and it was taken up by Wittgenstein in the Tractatus. Frege himself is not concerned with matters of verification, at least in the general case. So he doesn't explicitly raise the question whether, in the general case, the truth conditions of a statement can be verification transcendent or not. But he's generally read as, you know, given that he doesn't say anything about that, as not ruling out the possibility that there might be verification transcendent truth conditions. So that's the distinctive feature of realism in Dummett's hands, that not merely is a sentence's meaning given by its truth conditions, but that these truth conditions can exceed our powers of verification. So that's a Fregean origin for that idea. But equally, the anti-realist can trace the origin of that doctrine back to Frege through Wittgenstein's insistence that meaning is use, back to Frege's insistence on the publicity of language and on the publicity of meaning. And that's really what's at the bottom of Dummett's case for anti-realism, the thought that meaning must be both a public phenomenon and within our grasp, within our control, as it were. It must be possible for an understander to find out or at least recognize when a statement is confirmed or disconfirmed by evidence. And, I mean, the Wittgensteinian idea would be, I think, that we learn language in a way which embeds it in processes and procedures of verification. So you learn simple sentences in connection with methods of verifying or simply recognizing that they are true. You know, you don't start off learning language by being exposed to domains which are problematic, which are the ones that the realist and the anti-realist are really fighting over, if you like. You start off with very easy central cases where there's no problem about verification. Statements of the cat is on the mat form. Right? That's how you learn language, it seems. So the anti-realist is taking that point very seriously, you might say, and saying, well, it's essential to meaning that it should connect with verification in that way. And so the anti-realist is really harking back, as I said, to a kind of positivist verificationist position. In his middle period, Wittgenstein indeed said the meaning of a statement is its method of verification. And he is constantly saying things like, well, if you want to find out what a statement means, find out how it's used, look at its use. Don't sort of think about it in abstraction from its use, but see how it's used. And of course, a crucial feature of the use of at least many sentences will be how we go about finding out if they're true or not. So you might say that Dummett's thought is that the anti-realist is being truer than the realist is to our actual way of learning language and of using language in basic cases. Now, I think there's an unclarity here in the writings of anti-realists, which is to what extent they want to say that we simply don't understand statements that we can't verify. Okay, so I mean, that was the hard-nosed logical positivist position. If you can't verify it, then it's not meaningful. If there's no method of verification for a purported statement, then it hasn't actually got a meaning. You know, that's what the positivist said about religious and ethical statements and so on. Dummett seems not to want to say that. He never does go as far as saying that, so far as I'm aware. He tends to say things like, well, so if you take a case like the remote past, where we're talking about an area where there is no surviving evidence, right, and we want to speculate, I don't know, as we've been doing on previous occasions, say about the origins of language, parts of the of human history, from which no evidence has survived, and we just have to speculate. So there's no method of verification in these cases. Do we want to take a hard-nosed verificationist line and say, well, in that situation, these statements are simply meaningless? Dummett, as I say, tends not to say that. He tends to say, well, such statements are meaningful, but their meaning is to be given in terms of assertability conditions. So they get their meaning from what would count as warranting or justifying their assertion, what would count as recognizing their truth. So they get their meaning in terms of the sorts of evidence that would tell in their favour or against them. Another idea that has sometimes been floated is that in the case of such statements, we should work with what has been called an ideal verificationism. That's to say, we imagine a being whose powers are superior to ours or who has much more evidence. And we think in terms of how that being would go about verifying the areas that we ourselves are not able to get evidence about. So we think in terms of super beings, if you like, who are able to discern areas of the world that are inaccessible to us, whether because they're too remote or because they're too complicated, they involve higher infinity and so on. We, as it were, make up for our deficiencies there, the idea would be, by imagining super beings who didn't have those deficiencies and could survey these domains in a way that we can't. And we think, well, what answer would these people arrive at if they were asked about the truth of this statement? So if you're an anti-realist, you might try to make sense of the meaningfulness of unverifiable statements in terms of beings who were ideal and were able to verify things that we couldn't verify. And maybe if we help ourselves to that notion, we can entitle ourselves to say, well, these statements really are meaningful, even though we ourselves can't verify them, wouldn't be able to recognize them if they were true. They're well beyond our powers. But we can imagine beings for whom they're not well beyond their powers. And in that way, we can still think in verificationist terms about the meaning of these statements. Well, I've introduced that as an idea that an anti-realist might make use of. But actually, sometimes Dummett suggests that it's that the boot is on the other foot, in the sense that sometimes he suggests that that's how the realist has got to think about these awkward domains in terms of an ideal verificationist. And the way he gets to that thought is by picking up on a point that I hinted at a bit earlier, where I said that, look, you know, if you imagine the cases that are most favourable for language learning, so cases where people are talking about the objects in their immediate environment and manipulating those objects and issuing commands and so on, and making statements which are all easily verifiable. And I said something like, the realists and the anti-realists don't get into a dispute over that. But of course, that was actually a bit inaccurate, because even there, the anti-realist and the realist are disagreeing about what constitutes the meaning of a statement. Of course, what they don't really get into a dispute about is whether those statements are meaningful in the first place. Whereas, as I've been suggesting, there is a question mark over whether the anti-realist thinks that statements that are unverifiable by us are genuinely meaningful. But the way Dummett tends to cast the debate is he tends to say what I was saying earlier, that the realist and the anti-realist actually agree in their accounts of meaning on these easy domains. So they agree about what meaning consists in. So in effect, the realist agrees with the anti-realist that in the simple domains where we're talking about medium-sized objects in our environment, truth conditions and assertability conditions do indeed coincide. These statements are verifiable, and their verification is intimately connected with their meaning. That's Dummett's idea, and that then when we move to these more awkward and remote domains where we're not able to verify, then Dummett's idea is that the realist actually makes use of the idea of ideal verification. So the realist, in effect, is conceding the anti-realist case and saying, well, the meaning of a statement is given by its assertability conditions. And for those situations where we can't get ourselves into a position to assert a statement or its negation, we will make use of the idea of an ideal agent who is able to ascertain whether this statement is true or false. So we will go on applying the principle of bivalence to this domain, and we will say, well, there's no disconnection with verification if we think in terms of the ideal verifier. So true statements will still be verifiable by the ideal verifier. Whereas the anti-realist at that point, on Dummett's characterization, would say, well, we simply don't know whether statements in these areas are true or false because we can't verify, we can't ascertain one way or the other, so we should simply reserve judgment on the truth value of statements about domains which are beyond our powers of verification. And that's precisely what leads to what many people regard as what's so counterintuitive about the anti-realist position. I mean, if you take an area of the past where the evidence has not survived, you know, you say something like Julius Caesar had bacon and eggs for breakfast on the morning of whatever, and there's no way now that we're able to ascertain whether that statement is true or false, an anti-realist would say, well, we shouldn't assert that it is either true or false. We should draw our horns in and reserve judgment on the matter because it goes beyond our powers of verification. Whereas the realist wants to say, well, we can't ascertain whether it's true or false, but it must have been one of them. Either he did have eggs and bacon for breakfast on that morning or he didn't. One of those statements has got to be true, even though we can never find out which. And the realist, I think, has the more natural position there. We are inclined, I think, to say in that kind of case, well, there is a fact of the matter. You know, there's a way the universe was in remote periods of history which are well beyond our powers of ascertaining how it was. So I think one's natural thought there is to go with the realist and say that the anti-realist is tying verification too closely to meaning. Although, on the other side of the debate, what I said earlier about the language learning situation is very intuitive. That seems the right thing to say, that we learn language in situations where we are able to verify the truth values of statements. And that does seem very important to language learning. It seems as though it couldn't proceed in any other way. So there surely must be some connection between meaning and verification. But it can't be so close that statements that cannot be verified either are meaningless or even lack a truth value, as Dummett's anti-realist wants to say. So I don't think it's right to represent the debate, as Dummett sometimes does, as that realists and anti-realists agree about the meaning theoretic status of verifiable statements, or what's sometimes called effectively decidable statements. even there they are in dispute about not which statements are meaningful or which statements are decidable. They agree on those things. But what they're in dispute about is the extent to which the decidability of a statement constitutes its meaning. Okay, let's say a little bit more now about the arguments that Dummett gives for anti-realism. We've already broached them a bit, but let's fill them in. He basically has two arguments which go under the labels the acquisition challenge and the manifestation challenge. The acquisition challenge is this: according to the anti-realist, the realist can't give a satisfactory account of how we come to acquire a conception of meaning that potentially outstrips verification. So in other words, given that the learning of a language was, as we've already said, in situations where we were dealing with effectively decidable statements, so easy statements about medium-sized objects in one's vicinity, that's how you learn a language, and the statements are all easily verifiable, how would you come to understand statements in such a way that they might go beyond that? They might be meaningful but unverifiable. How could you have acquired that reach, as it were, in your understanding, given that the learning situations are ones in which everything is effectively decidable? So in other words, the anti-realist challenge is to say, well, how could you have acquired a conception of the meaning of a statement in terms of its truth conditions in such a way as to allow those truth conditions potentially to outstrip your powers of verification or recognition? As we've said, you learnt language in situations where that never happened. You were always able to verify and recognize when statements were true. So how could you have learnt a conception of truth conditions that didn't involve that ability on our part to verify the truth value of a statement? How would the realist respond to that challenge? Well, I think on the basis of considerations that we've already discussed, having to do with the principle of compositionality. This is, I think, an interesting point where it comes in. As I've been agreeing effectively on the realist's behalf, the statements in which we learn language are indeed ones where we're dealing with effectively decidable sentences, and that's almost certainly how it has to be. It's very hard to see how we could learn a language starting from undecidable statements, say statements about the remote past. How could you teach somebody a language if you were training them in sentences which didn't have a verification, or not one that we could carry out? At any rate, no, it seems clear that language must be learned in situations where the child or the language learner is able to see the truth of the statement, is able to recognize the truth, and is able to follow simple procedures to ascertain whether the statement is true or false. So, yes, in the learning situation, verification is very important. So when you're learning a statement like, the meaning of a statement like, the cat is on the mat, that is learnt in situations where you can find out whether the cat is on the mat by going and looking. But then I think the realist will say, well, yeah, but once you've, you know, that's the first stage, as it were, but once you've mastered enough of the language in that way, once you've, as we say, learnt the meaning of the word cat, the meaning of the word mat, and so on, then you can start to understand statements in the first instance which are not so easily verifiable, right? I mean, they might in principle still be verifiable, but they might in practice not be. You probably don't have to have got very far in learning the language before you can at least start to understand a statement like, there might be a cat on a mat on the dark side of the moon, or down in some cave which we can't get to. Something like that. So at a certain point, you start understanding statements which are put together out of bits that you know the meanings of, and you know the meanings of these bits because you've learnt them in simple sentences where verification was easy, it was straightforward. And then you proceed to cases where it's much more difficult, such as the ones I just mentioned, although In those cases, it's not in principle impossible. We could send a spaceship to the dark side of the moon to see if there's a cat on a mat there. So it's not utterly impossible for us to do that, but it's extremely difficult. And then it seems not such a big step to move from there to cases where actually we can't carry out the verification. You just make the spatial distance maybe a bit further, or you put it into the remote past, into a bit of the past where we no longer have any evidence. I mean, once a child has understood things like remembering that the cat was on the mat yesterday, it doesn't seem so far from there to understanding the scenario in which the cat was on the mat yesterday, but nobody noticed it, and no other evidence has survived, so that we actually don't know whether it was on the mat, but it might still be the case that it was at some point. That doesn't seem so large a leap from where you've got to. And the reason why it doesn't seem so large a leap is that you're making use of the principle of compositionality. You're putting together bits that you understand, and yes, you understand them on the basis of a training in decidable statements, but once you've had that training, you're able to put them together in new ways, in particular into statements which are not effectively decidable. And because you understand the bits and the grammar, the way they're put together, you'll count as understanding the whole sentence. So I think the principle of compositionality can come to the realist's rescue here and answer the anti-realist challenge, in effect, head on. An even more direct response to the acquisition challenge, which is sometimes given on the realist's behalf, is to say something like, well, yes, it's true enough that when we learn language, we always learn it in situations where we're manipulating sentences that are effectively decidable. That's quite right. Sentences about simple, concrete objects in our immediate vicinity where we can easily ascertain the truth or otherwise of the relevant statement. Fine. But although verification is important to learning the meanings of these statements, the connection is not as close as the anti-realist wants to make out. And in particular, the statements that we're learning the meanings of in that way are statements about an objective world. And that's to say, about a world that is, as the realist would say, independent of us. So when the child learns the meaning of the sentence, the cat is on the mat, the child's able to manipulate that sentence and respond to questions, respond to commands, and use the sentence correctly in various situations. So when the child gets to the point where we really want to say, yup, that sentence is now understood, tick. This realist will say, well, the child understands that sentence as being about a piece of the world, as being about a piece of objective reality. And that's important, that's essential. If you don't think of the sentence in that way, you haven't yet understood it. So in other words, it's part of coming to learn a sentence, the meaning of a sentence like the cat is on the mat, that you understand that sentence to be about a state of affairs in the world which is entirely objective and independent of human beings. So it's there or not regardless of whether it's being observed or ascertained or verified. So although we learn that statement in contexts where we can verify whether the cat is on the mat, we learn it as a statement that is about an independent objective reality, one that is in principle there independently of our methods and procedures of verification. So the child has to be able to think of the cat's being on the mat as something which can be there in the absence of any observer. Yes, you have to observe it in order to verify, but in principle, the cat can just be sitting there on the mat, as in our earlier example, and leave no traces of its sitting there, so that nobody sees it at the time, and subsequently there's no means of finding out whether it was on the mat. Unless you understand the sentence as relating to an objective state of affairs in that sense, then you don't really understand it. If, for example, you think in a strongly idealist way, so you think of the cat, as it were, as popping into existence on the mat whenever somebody looks around at it, but then going out of existence when nobody is observing it, this sort of Berkeleyan kind of scenario. If that's how you think about it, then the realist would say, well, you haven't really understood the sentence yet. You're not actually fully understanding what's going on here, because this is a sentence about an objective world, and you've got the wrong end of the stick there. you've got to be able to appreciate that if somebody says to you, well, is the cat on the mat in the next room? You know, the reply is something like, well, it was last time I looked, but whether it still is, I don't know. The reply is not something like, well, nobody's observing it, so no. I mean, there's no state of affairs there of the cat's being on the mat or off the mat for that matter. It's simply indeterminate because nobody's looking. You know, we might want to say similar things, of course, about Schrödinger's cat, but we don't want to say things like that about ordinary cats on ordinary mats. Okay, so that's how the realist might respond to the first challenge, the acquisition challenge. The second challenge that Dummett poses is called the manifestation challenge. And that is drawing very directly on the Frege publicity requirement and the slogan that meaning is use. The idea here is that the understander should be able to manifest his or her understanding. So understanding shouldn't be a matter of how things are in a merely private region of the mind, as it were. It should be a public phenomenon that can be manifested. So if you understand a statement, that must be clear in your behavior. And then the thought is, well, that's okay for effectively decidable statements. Your understanding of those can be manifested by, for example, instigating a procedure to find out whether the cat is on the mat, etc., by engaging in a process of verification or falsification, you are demonstrating your understanding, you're manifesting your understanding of the statement in question. Whereas if it's a statement about, say, the remote past where we no longer have any evidence, there's nothing you can do, according to this anti-realist line of thought, to manifest your understanding of it. So that if we go back to the statement about Julius Caesar and what he had for breakfast on a particular day, there's no procedure that you can go through to find out what the truth of the matter was. And so the anti-realist is inclined to say in that situation you should reserve judgment on whether the statement in question is true or false. And the reply that is sometimes made to the anti-realist manifestation challenge is particularly the reply that John McDowell gives, is to say, well, yes, we do have to manifest our understanding. That's absolutely right as far as it goes. But we can manifest our understanding of a statement just in virtue of using the language. So this is a bit like the move we considered before with the principle of compositionality. It's a kind of parallel move to the one which says, yes, you can acquire an understanding of unverifiable statements just by virtue of your acquisition of the language. You acquire that in easy situations, but then because of the principle of compositionality, because language is compositional, you can then construct and understand new sentences that deal with more difficult cases, unverifiable cases. So it's a bit of a parallel move to that, because you might say, well, sure, in the easy situations, in order to count as manifesting understanding, there are things you would have to be able to do in a fairly physical sense. So in order to manifest your understanding of the statement like the cat is on the mat, you would have to be able to do things like walk into the next room to see if it's on the mat, if that's where the mat is, right? And if you weren't able to do that, if you weren't able to manifest your understanding in that sort of very obvious physical way, then there would indeed be a question mark over whether you understood the statement in question. You know, if we're wondering whether there are any biscuits in the tin, and you've got no idea about how to find out, how to ascertain whether there are any biscuits in the tin, then that seems to be a case where we would say, well, you don't really understand the statement, because in these sorts of basic situations, these easy situations, understanding a statement is very closely connected to being able to verify, to be able to instigate a procedure that will lead to the recognition of the truth or falsity of the statement in question. But, again, the realist will say something like, well, once you've mastered those techniques, once you've learnt language in these basic situations, you've learnt words and their meanings, you've learnt syntax, you've learnt how to put together sentences that are new, you've learnt how to understand new sentences, and these new sentences can go beyond your powers of verification. You can still understand them, even though you're not able to put in train any kind of procedure of verification, and you understand them on the basis of your understanding of the language, the way the words are put together. So what McDowell would say is you manifest your understanding of these sentences by virtue of speaking the language. You know, you can talk about it. So, for example, we can have a discussion about whether Julius Caesar had such and such for breakfast on a particular morning where there's no evidence one way or the other. And we can speculate about the consequences of the truth of a statement. So we can fit it into a process of reasoning. You might say the statement rubs shoulders with lots of other statements whose truth value we may well be able to verify. It's placed in a context where we understand what's going on. In that way, we manifest our understanding of the statement itself, even though we can't verify that little particular piece of the jigsaw puzzle. Nevertheless, it's part of a bigger picture where we know what's going on and where we can verify, put in procedures of verification in place for other statements. So that the connection with actually physically going and looking, as it were, sort of very direct means of verification, is there, but it's looser, it's more indirect than the anti-realist wants to say. The anti-realist is kind of insisting that there should be such a procedure for absolutely every sentence you understand if you're to go along with an unrestricted principle of bivalence. If you're to say, well, this statement is indeed either true or false, then the anti-realist is insisting that you should be able to find out which. Whereas the realist is saying, well, that does apply in a sense to the basic situation, but once you've mastered the language, you can then move to a new situation in which you're able to manipulate sentences and think about possibilities, speculate on things, and that can take you well beyond the point at which you're able to verify the relevant matters. But you still count as understanding these statements, and you still count as having the right to assert an unrestricted principle of bivalence on the basis of the fact that these statements are composed of bits that you understand in a way that you understand. They're part of a language that you can speak, and you manifest your understanding of these statements in speaking that language. And I'll just mention in closing a third anti-realist argument that's put forward by Wright. And this says, well, we think of truth as a regulative ideal, as something which has a normative role to play in our lives, and that's something we've talked a bit about already. So if a sentence is true, that has normative implications. I mean, it's quite hard to spell out exactly what they are, but broadly speaking, we should have a tendency to believe it rather than disbelieve it. In general, we should be inclined towards believing the truth rather than not. So true statements have a sort of a regulative normative role. They have a to-be-believedness about them, in some sense. And Wright asks the question, well, but if that's correct, how can undetectable truths have that regulative role? How can they discharge that normative function? You know, the realist believes in truths and falsehoods that are beyond our powers of verification. We simply can't detect them. So they're not really playing any role in our lives at all, these truths and falsehoods. So they're not doing the sort of thing that truth is supposed to do. They're not discharging its special normative role. But here I think the realist can reply that it's a mistake to treat detectable and undetectable truth as being two species of truth, in the sense that you might demand separate procedures for ascertaining each kind of truth. And that, of course, would lead to absurdity in the case of undetectable truth, because there is no procedure for ascertaining truth. But the initial thought, which was that truth plays a regulative role in our lives, doesn't justify those further ramifications. So the realist might say the regulative ideal that plays a normative role in our lives is just truth, full stop, not any particular species of truth. Truth plays a regulative role, and then it turns out that in some cases truth is undetectable, but the realist is not then to be embarrassed by the question, well, what sort of regulative role does that species of truth play in our lives? You've said truth plays a regulative role in our lives, and now you've said, well, some truths are undetectable, and you're not going to be able to find a regulative role for those ones, so how do they fit into your picture? No, the point would be that truth as such plays a regulative role, and then some truths are detectable and some are undetectable. But we don't need separate stories, as it were, connecting up these two types of truths to distinct linguistic practices. I mean, it's a bit like the situation we have with, say, numbers, and this is a pointer as to the direction in which this debate might go. You might say, well, you know, we learn about numbers by manipulating very small numbers. And then the number system, as it were, generates of itself much larger numbers on into infinity. But even if we stick with the finite case, it generates huge finite numbers that we're not able to manipulate. They're just too big for us, right? So there we have a situation where our means of acquiring our knowledge of numbers in the first place is necessarily tied up with our ability to manipulate them in simple computations. But the things that we're acquiring knowledge of, the numbers themselves, they are able to go beyond our powers of manipulation and computation. They are such that they form a domain which reaches out into the large finite and ultimately into the infinite, where we, as it were, can't follow them. So that you might say, well, a similar situation obtains in the case we're interested in with truth, where we acquire our grasp of what truth is and of what the world is, connectedly, of course, what reality is. These are the two sides of the same coin. We acquire our understanding of these notions in simple situations where we're easily able to verify statements. But the thing we're acquiring an understanding of, namely the conception of an objective world, if you like, goes beyond what we can verify. So again, a simple example that I gave before would be the use of memory. We use memory and other ways of finding out what happened in the past. But these, we think, reveal to us an objective world, a world that was there anyway. The things you remember are things that happened anyway, whether you remember them or not. You remember them, but you know, they would still have been that way if you didn't remember them. And there are other areas of the past that you don't remember, but you don't think that they're indeterminate for that reason. So similarly, you learn how to find out truths about the world, but in the process you think of yourself, this is what the realist would say, as acquiring an instrument to detect how things are in an objective reality. And what that means is in a reality that potentially outstrips your powers of finding out how things are. Just as you can remember that the cat was on the mat yesterday, but your ability to do that depends upon your thinking of that as an objective situation that you're remembering, which could have been that way or another way, regardless of your ability to remember it or not. So your memory is hooking onto something which is independent of it. So the world is richer, goes beyond what you can remember. And similarly, you might say, in learning to verify simple statements when you learn language, you're learning to confront an objective reality. You're learning to talk about an objective reality. And what that means is a reality that then can exist in the absence of your powers of verification or your ability to recognize whether something is true or not. Okay, that's a good point at which to leave the matter. We've broached some questions and I've suggested one or two directions in which you can pursue this.